Let's start with the SEO summit in Kazakhstan, Astana. How did you find this summit and how important is this? We've learned that China and India, who had a lot of tensions, little tensions, but important tensions, they have decided to talk about their differences.
Well, for those people who pay attention, the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, SCO, has been around for decades. This is not a new association, nor have its goals and objectives changed much, at least according to its documents and according to the statements made by the people who led it. It was organized many years ago, basically by Russia and China, and it has now grown as all of these kinds of organizations in Asia have grown to include India, China, Russia, and I don't know, half a dozen or more other Central Asian countries like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and all of that. These are parts of the world about which Americans and Europeans know very little and pay very little attention. For example, you would have been hard-pressed here in the United States, looking at any of the mass media to know that there was a meeting in Kazakhstan, let alone what it was about, who was there, what it did or did not accomplish. If there was any treatment of the subject, it was condescending, dismissive, arrogant, and unpleasant to read. You know, I have recently been spending a lot of my time trying to explain to my American audience the importance of the elections in France, which took place on June 30th and July 7th. And then between the two of them on July 4th, the election in England. I didn't have the time, and I knew there was little interest in learning about the SCO meetings, which were also happening around July 4th. And yet I would have had the same introduction. I would have begun by talking about the childish ignorance that pretends these things are either not happening or not important enough. So let me tell you why I think they are important. These are signs. No one of them is dominant as a sign. They've been meeting for, I think, 24 years now, the SCO. No one meeting is crucial. This one wasn't either. On the other hand, the phenomena is extremely important. What we are seeing is the step-by-step development of a new world order, nothing less. I mean it to sound as dramatic as I've tried to make it. Whether you look at BRICS or whether you look at bilateral arrangements, wherever you look, nations of the global South, including China and now also Russia, because it has reorganized and refocused itself on Asia and the global South, who are, by the way, saving Russia in a time of its war with the West in Ukraine. So these are very concrete, specific relationships being built up. And they are crystal clearly defensive. They're not organizing military bases. They're not doing most of the things that we associate with people who have military or aggressive intentions. The best we can tell is that these are defensive, that these are efforts by Russia and China to defend themselves against the hostility of the collective West. And I believe they should be understood as movements in that direction. They should be read as the efforts of formerly marginalized, excluded parts of the world, definitely subordinate to the West. Many of these parts of the world were either colonies or quasi-colonies of the collective West not so long ago. And so it should be seen as they are emerging from the long legacy of colonial past. They are responding to the dominance of the American Empire over the last 75 years since the end of World War II. And they are, whether they say so or not, reorganizing the world economy and giving themselves a larger place in it. That's what they clearly want. That's what they are achieving. That's what they have been achieving over the last, depending on which country you're looking at, the last 10 years, the last 20, 30, or even 40 years for the case of China, which is the leader of all of this, no question. Everybody recognizes it. But so far, one of the interesting qualities of the SCO, which alone would merit the attention it's not getting, is the fact that the Chinese, despite their obvious dominance in terms of their wealth, their power, their position in the world, are insisting to go along with the definition of the goals of the SCO as being a multipolar world, not a Chinese empire. Now, I'm not naive. I understand that you can end up being an empire even if you didn't intend it. And it's also possible that people who intend an empire don't tell you about it until it is a fait accompli. But the Chinese, who could be doing both of those things, and only time will tell us for sure what they are doing, but at least publicly, and at least at these conferences, and at least year in and year out, they seem to be moving more towards multipolarity. And the interesting question that should be the focus of discussion, media attention, debate among academics, the really fundamental question is, might we be, and by we I mean the human race, might we be at a point where we can stop having one empire after the other, the Roman, the Greek, the Turkish, the Persian, and so on? Are we maybe, after the British Empire, and now after the American Empire, might we actually now be on the verge, on the edge of moving to a higher stage of human community in which we don't have to have, and we do not want, and we will not permit another empire? I don't know what the answer to that question is. Nobody knows. But it is childishly shameful that in the West, the crude partisanship of holding on to a dying empire makes you unable to see or to discuss or to debate where you might next go. And so we are left in an ugly world, which we all feel, in which we are told that the struggle is between an old declining empire and a new one that seeks to replace it. And then we wonder why the whole world is a little depressed these days, why so many people don't bother. You know, the elections in Britain and France, nearly half the people didn't vote. And in the United States, that's what we expect. It's the norm here that half the people, more or less, half the people don't vote because it's not relevant to them. And especially here in the United States, where the half of the population that is likely to vote Democratic, you know, is debating how old and decrepit their particular candidate is. And the other side debates how criminal and old and decrepit their candidate is. I mean, whoa, what a comment on where the old collective West is. And when they speak, they're officials. And by the way, tragically, the new one in England, Starmer, no different from the old one. Just like the one who wins this November will not be very different from the one who loses. We already know that. So we continue this play acting, the charade game, in which Western leaders talk as though they are the center of the universe. They were once. But that's half a century ago. And people have to wake up and understand that meetings like the SCO in Kazakhstan last week are meetings that are milestones in the process of erecting a new international world order, just as the BRICS are, and just as many of the events we're watching are milestones. The war in Vietnam was a milestone. The war in Afghanistan was a milestone. In Iraq, a milestone. The war now in Ukraine is a milestone. And the war in Gaza is a milestone. In different ways, they are showing us how the world is changing, except that the people who run the old world don't want us to see it. Literally don't want us to see, let alone to discuss what's going on. I find it remarkable. I think I may have mentioned to you, Nima, I have the good luck to be married to a psychotherapist. So psychological ways of thinking are part of my life and have been for many years. And she teaches me that what we are watching is a process of social denial, a political system whose focus is no longer on plans for the future, no longer on debating what future we want. It's desperately holding on to something that isn't even there anymore. And that is a remarkable psychological phenomena, probably better handled through those categories than the ones in economics that I use.
Richard, the other thing that we see in this type of summits, like the SCO, is that the countries who have differences, like Iran and Saudi Arabia, Pakistan and India, they have learned that they have to talk to each other. They don't need necessarily being totally in line with each other to talk with each other, which isn't the case when it comes to the G7. All of the countries within G7 are totally in line politically with the United States. In any of these countries who disagree on some issues with the United States is not accepted, is not welcome.
Yes, I think, but you have to be careful a little bit. Part of it, what you're observing, is the recognition by countries like Russia and China, or China and India, or Saudi Arabia, Iran, and many, many others, is that they have more to gain by working out than they risk losing by being isolated and not unified. But this is an understanding that you will find in the West also. It's not dominant yet. You don't see it the way you just showed it in terms of the SCO meeting where these things were said. But let me give you an example in the West where something very similar happened. There's a way of understanding the elections in France that I am emphasizing because it shows how important they are, in terms of the lesson they give to the United States and to every other country in Europe, for example. Okay, here's how to understand that lesson. One third of the French voting population has been persuaded to support Marine Le Pen, the Rassemblement National, and the more or less fascistic direction they want to take France. Harshly anti-immigrant, very pro-capitalist, very hostile to the left politically, etc. Okay? One third of the French voters are now firmly supportive of Marine Le Pen and the RN party. And they have been successful not only in maintaining their base, but in growing their base. Not as quickly as they had hoped. And that won't change very much either, the situation for them for the moment. But here's what happened that I think is worth keeping an eye on. The rest of the French political landscape, what we might call the center under Emmanuel Macron, the sitting president, and what was surprising to everyone, but shouldn't have been, the left, the four key parties of the left, Socialist Party, Communist Party, Green Party, and the biggest one, La France Insoumise, which means in English, the France Unbowed, okay? Those four parties on the left, plus at least two parties in the center, for lack of a better term, they understood, like China and India and China and Russia and so on, they understood they had much more to lose being different, letting their differences be the dominant part of their relationship. So they overcame their differences for the purposes of the election and nothing more. And not even the first part of the election on June 30th. Under the French system, there are two elections a week apart. But only for the second one, on the 7th of July, did you see a coming together and an overcoming of differences. They had meetings. All the leaders of the French political parties met. And they and their delegates, their assistants worked out a plan to defeat Marine Le Pen and to block and prevent movement towards fascism. And they succeeded brilliantly. They learned a lesson. And by the way, the people who learned the lesson most acutely was the left, those four left parties, because they have been quarreling with one another almost endlessly, as left-wing parties do in many countries that keep them from being unified. What they saw in France was a very immediate, tangible sign of what can be achieved if the left overcomes its differences. There are quite serious differences, for example, between the French Communist Party and the French Socialist Party. And yet they overcame their differences, and the end result was that the two-thirds of France that are not fascistic are completely dominant in the new parliament. The Marine Le Pen and the RN have a quarter of the vote there. The other three quarters are not them and are not interested in moving in a fascist direction. And I'm speaking to you from the United States, where there is also a large left-wing voter base. But it's not organized. Nobody has organized it. And so there can't be conversations between an organized left and an organized center to defeat the organized right. We're not at that stage. We are underdeveloped politically in the United States, and we have been for a long time. But again, the French teach us that the kind of talking to each other, putting the differences on the table, that no pretense that they aren't there. You will see in the next few weeks, those differences will become important again in France, because the left now in power has to work out a sharing among the four left parties with Macron, who's still the president. All of that has to be worked out. And that's going to be the real content of politics for the next at least several months, if not longer. But those differences haven't gone away in Asia either. There are border tensions between China and India. There have been, and there continue to be. There are differences that China has with Russia about, for example, North Korea. And there are many other examples I could give, and you know them too. You know, the differences between Shia and Sunni didn't disappear. They are there, and they lurk all over the place. And who knows how this is going to work. But there are moments, and they are very precious, when people who have these differences can be brought together by what they have in common and by a common desire to manage their differences in a productive way. Wow, those are precious historical moments. They could be how Europe and Asia relate to one another now. They aren't, but they could be. The left and the center in the United States could do to Mr. Trump what the left and the center just did to Mr. Macron. If they were unified, if they were organized, if they worked together, which doesn't mean that they don't have differences and they don't have to work on those differences. But the interesting question, will the West learn the lesson of the Shanghai Cooperative Organization and what it achieved, and of those French elections on July 7th and what they showed and proved, if you're daring enough to face it?
Yeah. Richard, the other thing that it seems so important right now, Saudi Arabia is saying to the European Union that it will sell Western bonds if G7 countries confiscate $300 billion in Russian assets, Bloomberg reported. Right now, it seems that Saudi Arabia, other countries are just perceiving what's going on. And how do you see this sense among other countries who have their assets in the West?
Well, you know, I hate to say it this way, but then again, part of me doesn't. This is what here in America is called the chickens coming home to roost. What it means is the long-term consequences of big mistakes you've made are now beginning to teach you just how big the mistake was. And this is a perfect example. As the world reorganizes itself, as every country, Saudi Arabia among them, looks at the world and sees the changes, that the wealthiest bloc in the world economy is now the BRICS. Saudi Arabia understands it because it's part of the BRICS. It joined the BRICS because it thought this could be the case. And now they are discovering they were right. It is the case. This is the wealth. this is the growing power of the world. The collective West is losing, is shrinking. And they see it everywhere. And of course, if you see that, you begin to move to consolidate your relationship with what seems to be the winner and to be a little more standoffish, we might say, in your relationship with the loser, because you don't want this change to hurt your country. You want to benefit from what's happening. The same thinking that made you a docile follower of Washington and London and Western Europe is now the same logic is making you say, oh, this is my time to build a relationship with the East, with Asia. That's the whole point of the SCO. That's why there is a Shanghai Co-op. That was basically done for reasons of military and geopolitical security. That's what they said in the beginning. That's how they've defined the organization. So they're trying to develop security. They are obviously aware of the economics. They always were. But now they have a kind of sister organization, the BRICS, which is more the economic. They are more the military, security, geopolitical, but they are building solidarity. So of course, we won't know because these are things are kept secret. But here's a speculation, which is all it is on my part. Leaders in Saudi Arabia are saying to themselves, okay, how do we show our commitment to the BRICS and to the SCO, our reliability as an ally and friend within these organizations? Well, we can offer something now to the Russians we were never in a position to do before. Because we could, hypothetically, trade in the bonds we bought from France, Germany, Italy, US, sell them and buy the bonds of India, China, Indonesia, you fill in the blank. Whoa! We could do that and it would still be a way of holding our wealth. It might not be as secure as holding the wealth in the West. That's still maybe more secure. Well, maybe we'll go to the Russians and we'll say to them, here's what we'll do to you, for you. We will, what you read in Bloomberg, we will threaten Europe and the United States with unloading their bonds, thereby threatening their currencies, the dollar and the euro, with all kinds of instability when they cannot manage it very well. This will be an enormous favor to Russia. It'll basically prevent the taking of the 300 roughly billion in assets that the Russians had kept and that the sanctions seized. Okay, now they might have asked of the Russians something in return. I don't know what that is. My guess is whether they asked for it or not, the Russians understand perfectly well what kind of offer they are getting and what they will have to give as a reasonable exchange for that. Will it be armaments? Will it be investments? Will it be a change in Russia's position regarding Israel and Gaza? Might this even be connected to Israel's threat against Gaza City now that it just happened the last couple of days? I don't know. I don't know. But what you're watching again are the normal step-by-step adjustments to a new world economy, to what we just finished talking about in terms of the SCO. You're seeing every country is doing this. Every, without exception, every country in Latin America, every country in Asia, every country in Africa, and every country anywhere else in the Western Hemisphere, in Europe, they are looking at a changed world and they are adjusting, because not to adjust would be idiotic. Then they're not idiots. They're trying to manage. You know, some years ago, a desperate economy in Greece sold its number one seaport, Piraeus. It's not far from Athens, and it's the port on the Mediterranean. They sold it basically to China, so that China got an entry into Europe by owning one of the great ports of Europe. Now, it was how the collective West punished Greece because of the way Greece at that time was trying to cope with the collapse of 2008. And because radicals like Yanis Varoufakis, who was for a while not just a Marxist economist, but the finance minister of the Syriza government in Greece, he was trying, together with economists around the world that he was friendly with, to move Greece in another direction. The Germans led the Europeans in crushing all of that. Yeah, but in doing so, they helped to create the deal to sell Piraeus to the Chinese. In the long run, this finances, helps the Belt and Road Initiative. It gives a port in Greece at one end and China at the other end. This is not what they wanted. They did it. They brought it on themselves. And why? It's not because they're stupid, not at all. It's because they too are trapped in a new world. Greece solved its problems by finding one of the new rich countries in the world, China, who could afford to imagine buying and operating an entire European seaport. You know, every country is doing, Greece is doing it in its way. Nicaragua is doing it in its way. You know, Malawi in Africa, it doesn't really matter. And all of them have one thing in common. They are more and more interested in the bigger and richer player in the world economy, which should surprise no one. That's the history of the world. The whole world reorganized away from Britain to the United States when the British Empire gave way to the American Empire. So why are people unable to see what in the world is going on? That is all that you're watching Saudi Arabia figuring out how to optimally manage the new world economy, in which it is an amazingly important oil producer. Well, that's its issue, and that's how it's trying to position itself. And of course, it's going to work deals with those who are advantageous and who offer them a deal to make. Russia needs something. They need the West not to take $300 billion in reserves. And Saudi Arabia, you know, is sitting in a meeting there in their headquarters, and they suddenly, and I bet you this is how it happened. Suddenly, you know, some assistant deputy minister says, you know what we could do? And then comes up with this idea. And for the next 2 months, they think about it and they realize, and they talk to, you know, Foreign Minister Lavrov from Russia, and he goes back and he talks to Mr. Putin, and they realize we have a deal we can make here. But it's not them. The reason this happens is not because of Putin or Lavrov or the Saudi Arabians. It's the social conditions that created something they then could act on.
There is a new research coming out of the Gavini, a company that analyzes global military industrial supply chains. And it's so amazing, the result coming out. We talk about the semiconductors and how the United States wanted to sanction China. Right now, in this new research, they're talking about that China supplies 40% of all semiconductors needed for the production of key weapons systems to the United States defense industry. It's unbelievable. And at the same time, Stoltenberg recently was talking about that we are inviting Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea, Japan, in order to send a message to China that we are getting ready to fight them.
Yes, I think you have to understand the complexity of capitalism, but it is not a new phenomenon. That would be a mistake. Capitalism has always, and by always I mean if you go back three centuries when modern capitalism existed almost only in England, or maybe in England and the northwestern part of Europe and so forth. And then even later, it spans to Japan and the United States and Australia and all that. At all times, you could divide industry, capitalist industry, including agriculture, into those who were dependent on exports and imports for their business, and those who were not. Think of an industry whose inputs come from the same country and who sells mostly in the same country. Okay. A country like that, capitalists like that, who are mostly domestically focused, their inputs and their sales are domestic. They are okay, in many cases, with a free trade policy. Why? Because either it's irrelevant to them because they just work at home, or they can imagine expanding. That is, they can imagine exporting because the quality and the price of what they have to sell is attractive compared to what you have in the larger world. That's one group. Now there's another group of industries in your country, domestic, but they are much more sensitive, much more vulnerable to international trade. For example, they depend on imported inputs, or they depend on exports. And therefore, they are very concerned about how competitive their exports are in the world and how secure their supply chains for inputs are. They might be much more interested if either the export markets or the inputs are threatened by foreign competitors. The second group would therefore be much more interested in having the government actively intervene to secure their export markets and to secure their supply chains or their inputs. Much more interested in the government intervening than the first group. Okay? And now you have the ideology of capitalism, which has been coming out of feudalism and is very suspicious of the government because it associates strong government with the risk of having difficulties developing their capitalism. And then finally, the new form of anxiety about the government, which is the problem of universal suffrage. If you have universal voting, capitalists understand that they, the employing capitalists, are a small minority of every country, and that the vast majority are their employees. which means by voting, the employees could take over the government and use that to displace or disempower the capitalists. So they are very suspicious of the government, which is nice for the industries that don't need or want the government to intervene, but is not so good for the industries that want the government. All capitalisms have that fight going on. Sometimes it's open and you see it. For example, right now in the United States, you have an upsurge of industries that used to be pro-free trade, don't like the government, like laissez-faire, hate socialism, but the United States was so productive that the quality and quantity of its goods was dominant in the world trade, and that their supply chains were equally so profitable for everybody to participate in that they were secure. So we could have neoliberal globalization from basically after World War II until recently, 70 years. But now that is over and the balance is shifting. The chip industry has a real competitor. The electric vehicle industry has a real competitor. The solar panel industry has a real competitor. I could go on. We have China, or if you like, the BRICS. They are now a very powerful competitor. The United States exports have to compete with their products. The United States supply chains can be diverted to produce inputs for Chinese or other Asian producers. So now companies that didn't used to care have shifted. They now want the government to help them. They want tariffs. They want subsidies. They want hostility against they don't want any of that anymore. And they have found a champion in Mr. Trump, who needs to try to build a coalition to have any chance. And white supremacists are not enough. And anti-immigrants are not enough. He has to get a significant portion of capitalists to support him financially, ideologically, influencing the mass media, and so forth. And so he has decided in his own political career to get on the wave of shifting of capitalists from free trade U.S. dominance to protected trade, U.S. government. And Mr. Trump has successfully done that. By the way, that still leaves a large portion still of American capitalists who don't want that, who want a free trade policy. They're mostly supporting Biden. And they're very worried that they may lose. The Republican Party has now written its platform and is committed to an immediate 10% tariff against every country, everywhere in the world, and another 30% on top of that against China. Okay, that changes everything again. The whole world is watching, but the whole world understands the United States is defensively closing in on itself, and the rest of the world, which is the overwhelming majority, is not. Even the Europeans who follow are not following the same way. Give you an example. The tariff, Mr. Biden, who is supported by the anti-tariff forces, the tariff Mr. Biden felt he had to put on electric vehicles from China is now 100%. The Europeans have decided to put tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, but their maximum is about 48%. Okay, about a quarter of the electric vehicles now in Europe are made in China. They've already, there are none in the, almost none in the United States because of a tariff like that. Okay, but you can see the Europeans, they're not doing what the United States did. For whatever complicated reasons, they are worried. They are more dependent on the world economy than the United States, and this is hurting them. And how that's going to be worked out, or whether, listen, a leading commentator in Britain, George Monbiot by name, who is a leftist, recently advocated the rearmament of Europe, the development of a European independent, not NATO, not US, independent European, because the United States is no longer a reliable ally. Well, you could look at this and say the emergence of the BRICS, the emergence of the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, the shifting decisions of every particular country, such as the Saudi Arabian one we have been discussing, are already understood enough that the collective West is running in every possible direction to escape from what's happening. The French have a phrase, sauve qui peut, and that translates into English, everybody now is on their own. Save yourself if you can. Sauve qui peut. All right? You may begin to see an unraveling of the West that will surprise people, but it shouldn't, because it is in the cards. It is how these things often go. And there are enough hints already, as in my example of the tariffs applied against electric vehicles, that you should be able to say it won't be surprising, especially, for example, with a new government in Paris, in France, which is not hooked into this, whose first priority is not pleasing one or the other of the capitalist groups. You may begin to see all kinds of behavior. That would be my way of trying to get folks to understand how it is that in the United States, you can have, to answer your particular question, you can have a neoliberal political establishment focused on beating China at the same time that it is the political enemy of the Trump forces, who get the support of the capitalists most interested in holding back China. Very complicated, and people not knowing kind of which way to go. The Chamber of Commerce here in the United States, arguably the number one association of capitalist employers in the United States, is very much against tariffs, wants relationship with China to be improved, want there to be peace, want to emphasize the mutual benefits that the United States and China can get from open free trade with one another. So that's still a very powerful story. And poor Mr. Trump makes alliances with people who support free trade, even though he is trying to build, you know, that's because this is always a conflict. And on any given month, a corporation that was on one side of that issue may sell a subsidiary and buy or merge with another company, and therefore have a different attitude on this subject. happens all the time.
Thank you so much, Richard, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
My pleasure too. Thank you for posing these questions. It's an important way to make, to offset what we talked about at the beginning, the inexcusable manner of either dismissing or simply ignoring all of this. It reminds me of nothing so much, and I like to tell this story, of walking in the park and noticing that there's a small child, a two-year-old, a three-year-old with their parents. And suddenly, as they walk, they encounter a dog, and the dog barks at them. And the little child is frightened by the loud barking of the dog. So the little child puts his or her or their hands in front of their eyes so they can't see the dog. And they explain to their parent, now there is no dog, because in their mind, if they can't see it, it isn't there. And the parent makes a mental note to work with the child next week, next month, there's no urgency, to help the child learn that, yes, you don't see it anymore. However, it is still there. And all I do is I watch American leaders, Secretary of State Blinken, Advisor Sullivan, Biden himself, and they all remind me when I listen to Janet Yellen, the finance minister, they all remind me of that little child. They are putting their hands and they imagine that all of us join them in having magically made the scary barking China disappear. And we have to shake our heads and explain to them who will not hear us that China remains, whether you pretend or not.